Accession number 28351, Reel 2.
Lord Blakehurst, Reel 2. Yes, that was very prescient, wasn't it?
Yes, amazing. I can't remember who it was, but whoever it was brilliant.
So, during the phony war, I believe, having asked you about the OTC, I don't think I gave you a chance to explain what you were doing in the OTC at Shrewsbury. Were you getting any
training? Shot rifles, yes, and we drilled and we marched in step and we turned right and turned left when instructed and we went on a summer camp. It was all quite useful stuff. We had real rifles. And shot real bullets on the ranges.
And how did things develop for you? Because I understand you were going off to Hong Kong to see your father. Could I ask you about that?
When France fell in June 1940, Father said to himself, here we have a situation in which my wife and my two children are in England, I'm in Hong Kong, I'd like to have them with me so that at least the family would be together. So he sent a telegram to my mother right in the middle of the cricket season, which I thought was very bad timing, saying to her, bring the boys out here to Hong Kong. And it was the middle of the summer term. And so we set off. We were both yanked away from school, and we set off across the Atlantic to go to Hong Kong, not the Pacific, because Italy had just come into the war when it saw Germany defeat France. Mussolini said to himself, well, I'm onto a good thing if I come in on Hitler's side. And so we went westwards across the Atlantic in a ship called the Duchess of Richmond, which was unaccompanied by any warship, and we zigzagged across the Atlantic successfully.
That was a dangerous time, wasn't it?
Not so dangerous as it became later. I think the submarine danger became much more serious in the next year or two. But at any rate, it was thought safe enough for us to go unaccompanied in this fast liner. And we arrived at Montreal, we got onto the train there, the Canadian Pacific Railway, heading for Vancouver en route for Hong Kong. And as I recall, it seems very strange, but as I recall, on the railway we got a message saying you will not be allowed into Hong Kong because, they didn't say it, because the British government was worried about Japanese intentions, which was pretty obvious to everybody that was the reason. And European and American children were, and their mothers, that is, women and children of European or American birth, were being evacuated from Hong Kong compulsorily. They had no option. They were taken out and most of them were sent to Canada. And therefore we couldn't go in. So we stayed, and we had by this time arrived in Vancouver, beautiful city, and we didn't know what we were going to do. We didn't know whether we could go back to England or should stay in Canada. It would have been difficult to get back to England because the ships were full of Canadian troops coming over, and therefore there wasn't much room for civilians. So we then decided we had to stay in Canada and get some education. We had a wonderful month on Vancouver Island holidaying while we made up our minds. Then we went back to Toronto because the only introduction we had in Canada to anybody was to a doctor and his wife in Toronto. And anyway, there were some other Hong Kong friends of my parents who had already got to Toronto for the same sort of reason we were in Canada ourselves. So we went back to Toronto. I went to see the provost, that is the head of Trinity College Toronto University, who was extremely helpful. and admitted me. This was in the summer already of 1940, not long before the autumn term was going to begin. And my brother, who was younger, was admitted by a school, a boarding school outside Toronto called Ridley, and they gave us special terms because we were regarded with sympathy by the Canadians, and so we continued our education. And then on the 7th of December 1941, I remember listening to the radio announcing the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, and I thought that doesn't sound very good for Hong Kong either, and I was right because they attacked Hong Kong on the same day. And so we had an anxious time, and Hong Kong fell on the 25th of December, Christmas Day, and we didn't know for 6 months whether Father was alive or not. After 6 months we did hear that he was alive, but we imagined that his conditions were not very good, and indeed they were terrible. As everybody knows, the Japanese were not kind to their prisoners. After a bit we began to get regular news of him at long intervals, so if one had to wait for 2 or 3 months for a card from him or some other means of learning what was happening, one didn't know whether he was still alive by the time one got the card. And this continued. It must have been awful for my mother, as it was indeed for my brother and myself. But in fact he did survive, in spite of being 50 years old when it began, in spite of having had cholera during his imprisonment. He survived until the end of the war. His job in the camp was to grow the tomatoes.
And that would have been a camp in
Hong Kong? In Hong Kong, yes. Yeah. Fortunately for him, he was never moved out of Hong Kong. He spent time in two different camps in Hong Kong, both of which had barracks, I think, before the war. One was Argyle Street, and the other was Sham Shui Po. And they're still, those areas are still known by those names, I believe.
I believe you mentioned to me earlier, and it would be interesting to know this, that your father was very involved before the attack on Pearl Harbor and Hong Kong with the Hong Kong defense.
Well, he was a territorial soldier, yes. He was a captain in the Hong Kong Regiment, as it was called, and they, of course, took part in the battle. And another interesting point is that the Hong Kong Regiment was under canvas a week before Pearl Harbor. When I say under canvas, I mean they had been mobilized and were wearing uniform a week before Pearl Harbor. So that must have been because the British government, at least, had some serious fears about Japanese intentions. And the amazing thing is, in that case, how was it the Americans were caught by surprise? That's been a perpetual mystery to me. I haven't read enough about what the explanation would be, but it still astonishes me to recall that fact. And then he came out of Hong Kong in August, after several weeks after the war ended, was flown home and arrived. I remember meeting him in his shorts, khaki shorts and a khaki shirt and nothing else, and shoes, of course. And he didn't have any other clothes, as far as I recall. He was very thin, and we met in a flat owned by my aunt in London. And we didn't really know how to greet one another, because we'd seen so little of one another that we weren't on hugging terms. I'd mentioned hugging before. The background of that rather austere lady who'd been our guardian didn't help me to hug. I should have rushed into his arms. I didn't. I think I shook hands. I probably did greet him a little more affectionately than that, but I should have been absolutely, I should have been showing that I was overcome by emotion, as I was. And he was much the same. He'd been in a prison camp for 4 years. I suppose he wasn't good at showing emotion.
Very English.
Very, very English, absolutely so. English 1930s, not English 16th century.
Or today.
Or today.
Lots of hugging today.
That's
isn't
right,
there?
Yes.
It's gone.
It's
really
much better.
Yes, I think so. There's nothing wrong with warmth.
But much better to show one's feelings.
Yes, yes, it's better all round, isn't it?
But it was the empire, of course, which trained us not to show our feelings, because you shouldn't show emotion before the natives. I'm not allowed to use the word natives nowadays, but before the local people. That was the ethos of the empire.
Politically correct.
Yeah.
So you were at school at university.
At university in Toronto.
Yes.
Sir.
How was that going? How did you get on there?
I got on very well. I was reading classics, having come from a classical school, which is a very good classical school. I was top of the class in Toronto for a couple of years that I was there.
How was the war affecting Canada, you know, the Toronto area? Because you would have been there 1940 to 42
in Toronto.
Was there an awareness that...
Oh, yes. An interesting point is that until 1942, every member of the Canadian forces, whatever arm, was a volunteer. No conscription until, at the earliest, 42. When I joined up in July 42, there was no conscription. They were all volunteers. And the Canadian Armed Forces before the war had been minimal. I believe I'm right in saying that the total numbers of the Canadian Army in 1939, before the war began, were 2,000. This great big country. And then the reason why there was no conscription until 42 was political. Because there is, of course, in Canada, still, it is still a problem, and that is relations between the French Canadians and the English speaking Canadians. And in the First World War, the French Canadians had not regarded it really as their war. So they were really rather difficult. A lot of them, enough to be a political problem. Although there were some very good French speaking troops. The Vandoos, I remember, a regular army regiment from French Canada, and various other regiments did extremely well in the Second World War. But I do remember that when conscription was brought in Canada, when it was felt politically possible to bring it in 1942, one of Canada's leading ice hockey players, and ice hockey is the Canadian game, disappeared when conscription was announced. He didn't want to get called up. And that wasn't greeted with contumely, but rather disapproved of, but certainly by the English speakers, very much disapproved of by them, I suppose. But it's interesting that that could actually happen. So, at any rate, coming back to my own activities, in the summer of 1942, I went to the OTC camp in Niagara-on-the-Lake, which is next to Niagara Falls, and the university OTC lines were next door to the lines of a regiment, a a territorial regiment which was mobilizing, called the 2nd 10th Dragoons of Canada. And the commanding officer sent a note over to the commanding officer of the OTC saying if any of the OTC members were interested in becoming a provisional second lieutenant in his regiment, he'd be glad to see them. And I had by that time concluded that really I should join up and do my bit for the war effort, stimulated, I suppose, by the fact that my father was a prisoner of war. And so I went to see him, and he said, good morning, Blaker. We're going to fight the Japanese in the Aleutian Islands. Would you like to come? And I must have said yes, because I found myself in the regiment a month or two later. Fortunately, the Japanese found the Aleutian Islands too painful to be in at all, and so we didn't have to fight them to get them out. They left of their own accord. But I've thought since the war what a mistake I made by drifting, simply because they were next door to us in the camp, drifting into that regiment. It was a good regiment, but I should not have gone into the infantry. They were mobilizing as infantry, though they had been a reconnaissance battalion when they were in a territorial role, militia role, they would have called it. I made a mistake in joining an infantry regiment, really out of thoughtlessness regarding my mother. Because here was my mother, husband in Hong Kong. We didn't know whether he was alive or dead. Didn't know what he would be alive, what he would be like if he survived the war. Might have been unable to work. And I joined the infantry, which was, of course, the most dangerous arm. And I never thought about the effect on her. Remember that her fiancé had been killed in the infantry in the Battle of the Somme. And I regretted that sense, that I didn't say to myself, I should look for something safe for my mother's sake. And it must have been awfully painful for her, and she never complained at all. And as I say, she went to work in a munitions factory.
Yes, you haven't explained that on the tape. Could you tell me, your mother, I wonder what the financial situation of your mother would have been at this time,
difficult.
You know, being cut off from your father.
Yes. My father came to Canada on leave in the summer of 1941 across the Pacific. And at that time, he was allowed to remit to us in Canada, I think it was £1,000 a month, which was a lot of money in 1941. And then we had a very nice holiday with him in Ontario that summer. Then he went back to Hong Kong in October 41, just in time to be to become a prisoner of the Japanese. He had just sent to us £1,000. I'm not sure whether it was £1,000 a month. I don't think it was. More like £1,000 a quarter, I think. Anyway, he had just remitted to us £1,000, and the authorities, when he became a prisoner, the authorities said, you have to send back that £1,000. I'm not sure whether it was when he became a prisoner or when it was, but soon after we received it, we were told it must have been before the Pacific War began, because we were told you must send back that £1,000 because it's unauthorized. And if you don't send it back, you won't be allowed any more. So it must have been still in peacetime because of the talk about having some more. So that was a bit of a blow. So we were not affluent, but we had enough money to have a car and a nice, a neat little apartment in Toronto. But then, of course, when the Pacific War broke out and father was a prisoner, my mother got the allowance of a captain in the British Army, because that's how he was treated. Wasn't very generous. And that reason, as well as the fact that she really wanted something to do and she wanted to contribute to the war effort, is what led to her working in a munitions factory, which she did for several years. My brother was, of course, as I said, 2 years younger than I was. He was at this boarding school outside Toronto until 42, when he also went to Trinity College, Toronto University, and they came back to England in the summer of 1944. And my brother joined the intelligence corps. He had German and Italian. He'd been studying at university, so he had good control of those languages. He was right to go into the intelligence corps. And his wartime activities, military activities, consisted of living in Naples and interviewing German prisoners after they'd been captured, and going to the opera in the evenings. So, you want me to talk about my wartime experience, probably?
Yes, I think we've got to where you volunteered for the Dragoons.
Yes, that's right.
Your mistake that you realised later on that it was...
Yeah, and you realised that really after the war. That was a mistake, because it was so unkind to my mother. Anyway, there we were, at Niagara-on-the-Lake, in a regiment which came from southern Ontario, that region. And I was sent almost immediately on a battle training course in Vernon, British Columbia, in the Okanagan Valley, which I enormously enjoyed. It was October. It was dry, fine, lovely scenery, apple-growing country, plenty of hills and ditches and so on, which were useful for training. And it was pretty realistic training. I mean, live ammunition was used from time to time to teach one to keep one's head down. I remember crawling along a ditch, with a wet ditch, with bullets flying over me from left to right, teaching me to keep my head down. At any rate, that was actually tremendously enjoyable. The weather was fine, as I say. And I was very fit, which was more than some of the other newly joined officers were. And indeed, I was recommended as an instructor there. But I never went there. When I got back to my regiment, my colonel told me, "You've been recommended as an instructor, Blake. I'm afraid we're going to lose you." But that never occurred. Obviously, they had enough instructors. So the next course I took, I had three courses in quick succession. The next course I took was at Kingston, Ontario, which was the either the School of Administration or the a staff college. I forget which. I think probably a staff college. Anyway, they were running courses for officers of my position, which is fairly newly in the army. And at the end of the course, I was interviewed by one of the staff, and he said, "Blake, what would you like to do? Would you prefer to be on the Q side or the A side?" And I foolishly said the A side, because I was full of the idea that my role was to fight. I would have been much better on the Q side, much better, because I wasn't suited to be a junior infantry officer, because I'd been taught to think too much. I'd been taught all this classics, which involved extremely painful thinking, the classical languages. And so when I actually got into battle, I would spend much too long thinking as a junior officer in command of a small number of men. I was going to say sit down. I wouldn't sit down and think. I would sing that, which exactly is the best thing to do. Whereas a more successful junior infantry officer would not have thought that much leading to inaction. He would have got on with it. And that would have been the best thing to do, because it would have taken the Germans by surprise, possibly.
So this alternative, this was more sort of on the staff, wasn't
and
it?
Q side was logistics and planning and that sort of thing, which I would have enjoyed enormously and would have been better at than I was on the A side.
End of Reel 2, Lord Peter Blaker.